Okay, here we go.
So today is the beginning of a six-part series, From Cradle to Grave, A Deeper Look at the Jewish Life Cycle. And many of us talk about the rituals from birth to death, and that's what many of our classes are going to focus on. This was really, this evening's class was an exploration for me that I haven't really looked into deeply before. It's what happens before birth. And as I was preparing the class for the last few days, I ended up in the middle of the night, as I was trying to feed two screaming infants at the same time, listening to a podcast from The Atlantic. If you like podcasts, I highly recommend The Atlantic's podcast. It's excellent. Jeffrey Goldberg often does it. And it was about Elizabeth Warren and her release of her genetic... her genetic analysis of where she came from biologically. And without going into the content of that, it struck me that all this like wave of technology, 23andMe and Ancestry.com, were all so interested and curious in where we came from. And I think that's a deeply Jewish idea, or a Jewish quest also, is to understand, you know, what the origin of humanity is, what our origin as individuals are. And to frame that discussion is worthwhile to go and look into these sources. So before we do, you know, the Jewish idea of an identity is focused and is developed already in Genesis, in the first chapter of Genesis, right? When God creates man, it's very clear that we as human beings are of two parts, right? Body and soul, guf and neshama. And our entire identity is some combination, and there's often a wrestling between the two. And so Chazal, the rabbis, identify this in a beautiful statement that they make in the first source of our source sheet tonight, which is talking about the idea of there being partners in the creation of each person. So if you'd like to follow along, it's source one in Talmud Bavli, Tractate Nida, where the rabbis teach Tanu Rabbanan, Shlosha Shutafin Yesh Ba'adam. There are three partners in the creation of every individual. Who are they? HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ve'aviv Ve'imo. God, a person's mother, and a person's father. And then the Gemara goes on to give the best possible idea of biology that the rabbis had 1,800 years ago, which if you read for yourself, it's fascinating. There seems to be male semen and female semen, and the rabbis thought that the male semen was the origin of certain body parts, and the female semen was the origin of other body parts. And given that we have doctors in the room today, I'm going to hold off on that part. Because Chazal were actually interested, the rabbis were somewhat scientific. They were interested in the best scientific knowledge of their generation. So they really wanted to explore that. But what's fascinating is that they understood that every person is more than just their biology, right? Because if it was biology alone, a male and a female could create that. But the idea that the rabbis present here in the Talmud is that we're more than just the genetic material of our mothers and fathers, right? There's also a three-way partnership that includes something that God gives us as well. And so that's the frame that I want to spend tonight, with tonight. We understand that we have genetic material. We'll see one more source in the Talmud that tries to understand the anatomical process of how we're created. I think that's an amazing source that really understood what fetuses looked like in the wombs of mothers, which is just fascinating. But we want to go a little bit deeper than that and understand what is the spiritual antecedent to who we are. You know, when do we develop our identities from the point of view of our neshama, of our souls? And so in the next 55 minutes, we're going to try to do two ambitious things. One is to trace throughout classic sources the process of the creation of a soul and the creation of a spiritual identity. That's kind of part one. And part two is to apply similar ideas and actually contrast them with the halachic discussions around the halachic status of fetuses and embryos before they're actually born. So that's going to be a 20-minute short discussion of what could be a 5-part series on Jewish views on abortion. So there's a lot for us to talk about, and I'm not going to spend any more time with the introduction, so let's go into part one. Part one, the spiritual transition of the soul into this world. There's one source that discusses, as far as I know, in Chumash, the idea of personality before birth. And we're about to read it in 2 weeks' time in the Torah. And that is the story of the birth of the second set of twins in the Bible that I know of, which are Yitzchak and Ishmael, right? If you look at the birth of Yitzchak and Ishmael, this is source two, you see something quite explicit in the Torah once you highlight it more. So would anyone like to read source two for us? We can do most of the reading in English, and then I'm going to highlight some of the words together in Hebrew. Yeah, Steve, you'll start, and we'll go around. Sure. We'll go around counterclockwise.
This is the story of Isaac, son of Abraham. Abraham begot Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old when he took to wife Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, sister of Laban, the Aramean. Isaac pleaded with the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord responded to his plea, and the wife Rebekah conceived. The children struggled in her womb, and she said, "If so, why do I exist?" She went to inquire of the Lord.
I'll just ask you to pause there. So here's what the rabbis are curious about in this verse, right? It's one thing to say that the children struggled in the womb, right? Vayitzro tzitzu habanim b'kuba. I think there are many women who experience the pain of pregnancy and the discomfort of pregnancy, and they, I don't know, I guess I'm fairly recent empathetic father to Mira, who just had two babies in her womb. But the language here in the Hebrew is Vayitzro tzitzu habanim b'kuba. The children, and the word Yitzro tzitzu from the Shoresh, the root ratzatz, is a very unusual root. So the rabbis are struggling to understand, why does the Torah use this unusual language? That's one question that they have. Vayitzro tzitzu. I don't think it's a modern Hebrew word. So great. So the rabbis say ratzatz, which is a three-letter root, might be connected to the two-letter root ratz, which in Hebrew means to run. So there's some kind of running, some race, competition, going on inside of the womb, right? And furthermore, what the rabbis are curious about, the thing in the text that strikes them or that leaps off the page to them is what her response is, right? Vatomer in ken lama ze anochi, right? If this is what's happening to me, why do I exist? Basically, Rivka's saying, this is so uncomfortable, I want to die. And the rabbis are curious, like, how bad could it possibly be? I guess they probably weren't so many women studying the Beit Midrash that day. So they probably didn't have that experience. But they're curious about what was so intense going on in the womb, in the belly of Rivka. And what they bring up, it's explicit in the text itself, that there's something about the destiny that Hashem already knew in the womb of Rivka, that these were two children with two very different destinies. And they were fighting against each other. Vayitzro tzitzu, it wasn't just that they were running at each other, but they were arguing. There was some kind of tension going on. A tension beyond just the natural biology itself. There was something deeper than that. And that's what the rabbis want to focus on. I'll just summarize the rest of the story in the Torah. So God says, what's the situation here? Hey there. Hey Kirsten. Hey Miriam. Welcome. Right? Shnei goyim bevitznech. There are two nations in your stomach. And there, in your innards, there are two different nations, right? And one is going to be stronger than the other, and the other one's going to, and one's going, the older one will worship the younger one. So there's this internal struggle already in the belly of Rivka. What I think is so fascinating here is that the Torah itself is bringing up the question of, you know, who are we by our identity? Are we just who we are by nurture? Or maybe there's something in our innate nature, right, before we're even born, it's going to define who we are. Are there enough source sheets to be shared?
I'll share with Miriam.
Okay, take two Miriams together.
Yes.
It's a good thing. And okay, great, great. So here's how the rabbis think about, or Rashi quotes two different midrashim and rabbinic commentaries on that question of what is going on in Vayitzro tzitzu, that the children were struggling or running at each other in their womb. So we're going to look at Rashi now. Pauline, do you have access to it?
If I listen to you, I'm just fine.
Okay, perfect. So, Uli, do you want to read the beginning of Rashi? Rashi is a 12th century commentary, one of probably the most important of the commentaries.
And the children struggled. You must admit that this verse calls for midrashic interpretation, since it leaves unexplained what the struggling was about, and it states that she explained If it be so, therefore I die. I did. Therefore I,
wherefore did I
desire this.
Okay, so basically, why am I here if this is what's going on with me? You can skip the parentheses.
Okay. Our rabbis explained that the word
Vayitrotsitsu
has the meaning of running, moving quickly. Whenever she passed by the doors of the Torah, i.e. the schools of Shem and Abel, Jacob moved conclusively in his efforts to come to birth. But that whenever she passed by the gate of Pagan temple, Esau moved conclusively in his efforts to come to birth.
Okay, so we'll just pause there for now. So that's Rashi's first answer. What is this running that's going on in Rivka's belly? That when they would walk by a Beit Midrash, a study hall, which is a place where Torah studied, Yaakov would try to get delivered, would try to basically exit into the world. And she was in extreme pain every time that would happen. And then on the other hand, when she'd pass by a pagan temple, right, Esav would try to have himself given birth to also, would try to be ejected from his mother's womb. And so what's the running that's going on here? That both children were trying to run out of the womb, just at different points. So what the rabbis are reading into in this first midrash that Rashi quotes is that there seems to be an innate nature, something predestined in the lives of Yitzchak and Esav, right? That before they were even born, they had different nitzio, different attractions. They wanted different things out of life. Yaakov wanted God, and Esav wanted some form of idolatry. Okay, so that's question number one. That's answer number one with what's going on pre-birth. Right? It's amazing that according to the Torah, and it seems to be a very simple explanation of what's going on, right? Our innate personalities, right, are based on nature and not just nurture. Right? Not everything can be created by the influence of community and parents. Some things are just there before you're even born. Right? You're nodding your head.
I mean, you should ask the woman,
kid. Yes, I defer. So that's answer number one. We'll see an even more extreme answer is Rashi's second approach. So, Ilya, do you want to keep going? This is the top of the second page.
The Gemara asks.
So another explanation. The top. So we're still in that Rashi.
Okay, I thought I read already. Okay. Another explanation is they struggled with one another and quarreled as to how they should divide the world, two worlds, as their inheritance.
Okay. So it's not a struggle about who they are. It's a struggle about their inheritance.
Even while they're in the womb.
Even while they're in the womb, right? Some siblings just never get along. Right? It's not only in old age. What's the two worlds here? The two worlds as opposed to one world?
Learning and
pagan.
Pagan and religious. So that's the first answer. The two worlds here is a reference to Olam Hazeh, the physical world that they're about to be born into. And the world to come, after the world that they'll inherit after they die. Right, who's going to get which world? Who's going to be successful in this world? And who's going to be successful in the next world? It's a different way to read the prioritizations. Maybe Yitzchak at an early age, we'll see this later, he was someone who was very consumed by Torah study. Right? All the Midrashim seem to focus on that. But he wanted Judaism. Right? He wasn't so interested in the physical benefits of this world. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was thinking that there was also, after the two were born, Isaac's favorite was not Jacob, but was Ishmael.
Yeah.
But he was sent out, and by circumstances he took another road. But he could have been Jacob, not Ishmael, in being part of our
world. So So sorry, we were between Yaakov and
Esau.
Right, between Yaakov and Esau. So Yitzchak is the father. No, and just to be clear, because I think I may have been unclear, I may have made that mistake before. So Yitzchak is the father of twins with Rivka, and there are these two different nations, Jacob and Esau, Yaakov and Esau, and they seem to both want very different things from the beginning. So Jerry, that's what you were saying.
No, I'm saying that just by circumstance, Esau could have been the Jacob. And the Jacob could have been thrown away, pushed away.
Yeah. So you're going about the story, right? So Yaakov's mother Rivka convinces her son, who is described as the Ish Tam Yoshev HaOlim, the simple one who likes to sit in tents, which the rabbis interpret as he liked to study. Right? Tents generally are references to study halls. So he didn't want anything of this world. Right? Rivka, though, convinces him, you better go and get that blessing of financial success. And she puts on the furry arm stuff, and they go and they trick the father. It seems like she's trying to convince her son, you should get this world too, not just the world to come. But what I wanted to use in this source is how the rabbis understood that so much of who we are is there before we're ever born, right? There's a lot of predetermined things to us, which brings the question, then if a lot of things are determined before we're ever born, do we even have free will at all? Do we have free will at all? Right? If our personalities are defined, if our desires are defined before we're born, so then what choices do we really have to make in this world? Maybe we are just a consequence of the circumstances in which we were born, what kind of community, right? What socioeconomic level, who our parents were, what religion they practiced. Right? Maybe we don't have many choices in life. And that's actually an undertone of the rabbinic literature about what happens before we're placed here on earth. So I want to explore that as we go into the next kinds of sources. So let's go to source four. And source four is interesting in that it brings up an important number that seems to trace both in Jewish philosophical, just one sec, Steve, Jewish philosophy and Jewish law, which is the number that you may have heard, 40 days. You may have heard this number being thrown around about pre-birth, that there's a 40-day period when the vlad, when the embryo or the fetus becomes significant, becomes existent, maybe. So we'll get into that in 1 second. What's that?
Is that the same as viable?
Not viable. Viable, I think, is way past 40 days of conception. But just when the... And Bill, anyone who with medical knowledge, please feel free to correct me here. I don't claim to be an expert. But I think viability is like somewhere in the end of the second trimester, and 40 days is still within the first trimester, like well, early in the first trimester. So before we get there, yes, Steve, go ahead.
Isn't there a saying, genetics is destiny? Isn't that a current saying, something like that?
Maybe. I remember taking in grad school, in modern philosophy, there's the idea of determination or causality. That there is a whole school of thought that there is no such thing as free will based on modern genetics. Philosophers are talking about this because if so much of what you end up doing in your life is just predetermined into your genetic code, then maybe you don't have free will to start with. So there is a school of thought in modern philosophy that takes that view. It's a modern form. You might call it scientific determinism. That everything you are is just a consequence of what DNA was put into you. And the rabbis struggle with that question. So let's go and see how they struggled. Two key terms that we have to explore now in the next two sources. So we're now exiting the Bible. I thought that was just an important kind of pre-source. And we're entering into the Talmudic period. So the Talmud is a combination, just quickly, of two things. It's the rabbinic work of the Mishnah that's codified in 200 of the Common Era. And then it's the commentary on that Mishnah over the next 300 to 500 years. So most of what we're going to quote today is from the Babylonian Talmud. It's the commentary of the rabbis who were exiled to Babylon. And it's basically a tape recorder before that existed that was put down in the study halls of Babel, of Babylon, and they pressed record. And then in the year 500 to 700, they started writing down the best parts of those conversations, of the commentaries of the Mishnah. And that's what we're going to spend most of our time studying for the next 40 minutes. Okay, so let's start with source four in Masechet Sota. And this is a source that speaks to the question of, before we're conceived, or maybe as we're conceived, are there things about us that are predetermined? What is determined about us by God before we even, or as we even come into existence? So, Yossi, do you want to try reading that source?
Just what is the book of this? First page.
Yeah.
It says, Eretz the Lord Yitzchak, then Abraham.
Yeah.
Abraham holided Yitzchak. Like, holid in Hebrew means give birth.
Or cause to give birth, yeah.
I think the Hebrew is kind of...
So it's interesting that...
It's like he gave birth.
Yeah. So yes, he's pointing out something in the grammar that maybe it's like, did Abraham give birth himself? So I'm not an expert here, but my knowledge, my basic knowledge of Hebrew grammar is that there's a difference between holid and yalad. Holid is to cause to give birth, and yalad is to give birth oneself. Or And I think here it's the causative form, which is that Avram caused the birth of Yitzchak to take place, and presumably it's his wife Sarah.
Say he holida, she should give birth.
He holida, yeah, as opposed to Yalda.
Oh, yeah.
I could be wrong, but I think in biblical Hebrew it might be Yalda. But I'm not sure, and if it's not a good answer, feel free to get back to me later. Say it again, Don.
What's the Hebrew for what they translate as bearing?
I think the word is akara.
And what does that mean?
Akara means without seed, often. Yeah, and that language comes up also in the book of Judges, barren, or barren, maybe infertile. That language comes up again in the book of Shoftim, when Hannah is not able to have any children. And eventually she goes to the temple, she's able to have the prophet Shmuel. So the same verb comes up there as well.
So it means without seed.
I think so. We could do a more precise translation later. But that the colloquial would be barren or infertile.
Well, no, I understand that. I was asking what the Hebrew was.
Yeah, it comes up in a few other places. In Psalms it comes up. And it, every time I've seen it, it means the same thing. Yeah, Ethel. Yeah, exactly. Chana is the Haftorah on Rosh Hashanah that we read about a barren woman as well. Yeah. Okay, so let's keep going and read source 4. Source 4 is the source that introduces the idea of 40 days. So what we have to be careful about here is that the Talmud has two different terms for the creation of an embryo, okay? The first term is pekida, which in modern Hebrew, or actually in biblical Hebrew, means to remember or to count. And the second term is yitzira, or creation. And so what it seems to be saying is that the first term is conception. Pekida, to be counted, is the moment of conception. And then later on, there's some other period of time, which is the moment of yitzira, of creation. That somehow, the way the rabbis thought about the biological process is that something happens in the moment of conception, right? But the creation of a physical thing that we can find and look at and call a fetus happens some point of time later. And the rabbi's conception of that difference of time between conception and actually identifying a fetus is 40 days, okay? What's interesting, though, is that the Talmud says that even before you can see a fetus, even before you can see a physical embryo, nowadays we have microscopes and all this amazing technology that, you know, we can actually see conception taking place. You know, anyone who's in vitro fertilization is actually where you create conception in a laboratory, right? But they didn't know that back then. They didn't have that technology back then. And so they were trying to figure out when can you actually find a fetus. And for them, it was 40 days. But what's interesting, according to the Talmud, is that even before the 40-day period, even before you could have a physical thing to look at, there are things that have already been decided for that future child. And so when we're talking about the question of predetermination, right, what is decided for us and what's not, the rabbis had a lot to think about in that 40-day window. So let's read about that in source 4. Yossi, do you want to read it for us?
The Gemara asks, is that so, that the man is matched to a woman according to his actions?
So just the context here is the Talmud's in a longer discussion about zivug, about matchmaking, and there's a famous statement that it's harder for God to create matches than it was for him to split the sea of reeds.
No, I
think it's
harder to make matches.
It's harder to make matches than to split the sea.
Yeah.
So in that context, this one-off line comes, and this is the one we're going to focus on here. So we're going to focus on Rabbi Yehuda's line. We're not going to go into the whole context of the Gemara for now. So keep going.
But Rabbi Yehuda says, that Rav says, the 40 days before the embryo was formed, a divine voice issues forth and says, the daughter of so-and-so is desired to marry so-and-so. Much and such house is destined to be inhabited by so-and-so. Such and so-and-so field is destined to be farmed by so-and-so. So
okay.
She's going to marry before it's a new womb already.
So great. And the Talmud continues to ask this.
Yeah.
So here's 40 days before the Yetzirah, before the creation of an embryo or a fetus. And remember, the creation, as opposed to conception, right, is 40 days later. So what we're saying is that 40 days earlier than that, at the point of conception, the moment, right, that now we would say semen fertilizes egg, right, and an actual embryo, the most basic form of embryo is created, at that very moment, God decides three things, right? Who the person will marry, what home they will live in, and what fields they would have, right? That's the third one, is the fields.
What kind of work?
Work.
So it's interesting, you know, the Talmud is speaking at an era where 90% of Jews were agricultural in their work. So maybe it's talking about your occupation. Maybe it's talking about how much food you're going to have, right? Where are you going to live? Where is your house going to be? Are you going to be born in Babylon, or are you going to be born in Israel? Are you going to be born in North America or Africa or Europe or Asia? Right? All of that is preconceived.
No free will, then.
So interesting. Is there free will according to this source in the Talmud? Let's pause and think about it for a second. Raise your hand if you think there's no free will based on what we've seen
according
here.
According to
just this source in, right, just this source in absence. Okay, so raise your hand if you say no free will. Okay, so we're up to about a third of everyone here. Okay, free will, is there still room for free will according to this source?
Maybe not so much, but some.
Not so much, but some. Okay. So what I think is important, and this is what careful, like in a yeshiva environment, what you'd always try to focus on is not just what was said, but what was not said.
What was intended.
Right. What was left out? What was purposely left out from this source? And there's a famous statement elsewhere in the Talmud, Hakol bidei shamayim, everything is in the hands of heaven. It's in God chooses everything except for chutz miyirat shamayim, except for the fear of heaven. And the way that's commonly interpreted is everything's in God's hands. Right? You don't choose where you're born and who your parents are, right? And not necessarily based on circumstance. You're not really in charge of how much money you're going to make in this world or what your job's going to be. Right? So much of that is circumstantial, right? And what is in your power, right? What kind of person you are, right? How you deal with the circumstances that you're given. Right? Maybe you're even given a personality, right? But according to one reading of that statement in the Talmud, you also have free will to try to overcome personality defects, right? To try to improve who you are. And I think that's what's intentionally left out here as well. A lot of stuff you have no control over. Right? You're not in control of where you're born and how much money you're going to have or who you're going to end up with or not end up with, right? That's in the hands of God. But you still have room within that, right, to fashion your own self, right? And I think there's a conscious point here that at the moment of conception, a lot of things are chosen for you, right? Just by dint of who those two people who conceived you are, right? And yet it doesn't determine everything about you, right? There's still something that's left for you. And the question that I saw one commentary write about this is, you know what's not preconceived? Right? Whether you're going to do mitzvot, whether you're going to study Torah, whether you're going to be kind to others, right? Your avodat Hashem, your worship of God, and your mitzvot between you and God and you and people, that's up to you, right? No circumstance can prescribe that for you. I think it's powerful when you think about Jewish stories of the Holocaust, how there were some people who really abandoned in the moment where their lives were the most pressed, right? Abandoned any sense of goodness, just were totally self-focused, right? And you have stories of Jews who were forced to basically give up on their sense of humanity and would give up and kill other people just for their own sense of survival. And you have other people who did incredible sacrifices. Right? There's stories about Jews in the concentration camps who fasted on Yom Kippur. Right? Like, where does that strength come from? Well, some things aren't determined by God. Some things are up to you. Okay. The next question we have, this might come off as piecemeal for now, but we're trying to trace an arc from conception, maybe even preconception, all the way to birth. The next source is a fascinating discussion in the Talmud. We're jumping tractates now. We're in tractate Sanhedrin, source 5. It's very clear the rabbis had an idea that the actual fetus only appears at 40 days, right? But they knew that something happened before the fetus appeared, right? By that point, 2,000 years ago, people figured out that the birds and the bees had something to do with children being born, right? And they understood that sex leads to conception, leads to fetus, right? So they knew that there was this 40-day period between when they could actually find a fetus or know that it was there and when it was conceived. And what they were curious about is that's the physical body, right? But remember, we started out by saying that every human being is of two parts, right? There's the body and there's the soul. And the Talmud records a discussion, and it's a fascinating discussion because it's between Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, who was the compiler of the Mishnah in 200 CE, and the Roman emperor of that day, whose name here is Antoninus. Okay? So Antoninus and Rabbi Yehuda Nasi have a debate. And it's not often that a rabbi will concede to the Roman emperor. But here the rabbi says, you know what? That Roman, he actually knows his stuff in this debate in the Talmud. And the debate is, when does the neshama, when does the soul enter into the fetus? Okay? So let's read this verse in the Talmud, verse 5. Jerry, you want to read it for us?
And Antoninus said to Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, from when is the soul placed in a person? Is it from the moment of conception or from the moment of the formation of the embryo 40 days after conception? Rabbi Yehuda Anasi said to him, it is from the moment of the formation of the embryo. Antoninus said to him, this is inconceivable. Is it possible that a piece of meat could stand for even 3 days without salt as a preservative and would not rot?
Okay, let's pause there. Huh? Okay, did everyone get that image or that metaphor?
No.
Okay. So this happens to be a kosher metaphor from the laws of kosher meat, that you're required to salt meat no later than 3 days after the animal was shechted, after the animal was slaughtered, to remove the blood from it. And if you don't do it by that point, then because blood is non-kosher, the animal is no longer kosher. You can't salt it after 3 days. Major debate in Israel today happens to be, this total aside, most Israeli meat comes from Argentina. Uh-huh. And it's very hard to salt meat in Argentina. So there's a debate. The chief rabbinate allows you to freeze the animal, the carcass, right after it's been slaughtered, and then it pauses the 3 day clock, and then they unfreeze it and salt it in Israel. But then the ultra-Orthodox community doesn't accept that, and they will only eat meat that's pre-salted in Argentina. So anyways, that's a total aside. But borrowing on that imagery.
Is that red meat?
Yeah.
What is part about salting in Argentina? You mean they don't have salt?
I think they just don't have enough, like...
Salt.
I think they have salt. I just don't think they have enough kosher specialists. Oh. That's my guess, but I'm not sure. So the image here is that, similar to this kosher phenomenon or this kosher dilemma is... within 3 days of killing an animal, if you don't salt it, the meat's going to start to rot, right? And so what's the comparison? The Rabbi Antoninus, right, the Roman pagan emperor, right, is saying that a body without a soul, even an early body, right, even an embryo, if it doesn't have its soul from conception, right, nothing physical can survive without its spiritual soul. And so it's interesting that the later Kabbalists have a similar idea. But the Kabbalists feel that even inanimate objects, they think even a chair has a soul, has some form of neshama, because they feel that anything without some spark of God in it cannot exist, period. And so a similar idea is happening here. Antoninus, the Roman emperor, is telling Rabbi Yehuda, not possible, right? You couldn't have gotten from day zero to day 40 if whatever physical reality there was didn't have a corresponding spiritual reality. And so let's keep going from that. So Antoninus is saying, not possible, right? The embryo could not exist for 40 days without a soul. Jerry, you want to go from rather?
Yeah, from rather. The embryo could not exist for 40 days without a soul. Rather, the soul is placed in a man from the moment of conception. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi said, Antoninus taught me this matter. And there is a verse that supports him as it is stated. And your providence...
Don't worry about that word.
Okay. Has preserved my spirit, indicating that it is from the moment of conception that the soul is preserved within a person.
Okay, the proof text here, and this is Midrashic wordplay, is that the verse in Job, in Eov, says, Upkudatecha shamra ruchi, your pikud has guarded my soul. And pikud, or pikida, was the term used for the moment of conception. Right, so from when have you guarded a soul within me? From the moment of pikida, from the moment of conception. So it's amazing, just historically, to press pause on this context here, that 30 years after the Bar Kokhba revolts, when the Romans totally decimated the land of Israel, right, there was a rabbi saying that that Roman emperor was actually right about the nature of the soul. Fascinating, right? Just in the abstract historical context. And
was
so,
Antonius the Roman Empire defeated
No, Titus was. So it's a
right,
different generation.
Right.
Right? But still, like, the fact that they were able to There's an expression, chachma b'goyim tamin, should trust wisdom of the nations, right? That we don't claim to have a monopoly on truth. And this is a moment where a very prominent rabbi was willing to say, I think there's truth outside of the Jewish.
9-10.
What's that?
9-10, it says in the Gemara.
Yeah.
Asarah kabin shel chokhma.
Right, and 9-10ths were...
Israel took and the 1/10 of the rest of the world.
Yeah, and so there's a skepticism among the rabbis to trust non-Jews for Torah interpretations or non-Jewish nations. But there is a measure of wisdom that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was willing to take from them. Okay, so far, we got from the moment of conception, right, 40 days on, to the moment where you can actually find the fetus. And the Talmud seems to agree with the Roman emperor that when is the soul entering? At the very moment of conception. Many rabbinic thinkers, Kabbalists in particular, Nachmanides wrote a whole book about this, felt that sex was the holiest experience that a human being could have. Because it's at the moment where sex takes place that a new soul has the potential of entering into the world, right? And so there's a lot of, if you go, this isn't so publicized, but in Hasidic communities, they feel that the moment where a couple has sex is the holiest moment of their marriage. And there's all these intents, and people actually have these meditations and prayers that they say beforehand because the potential to bring a new soul into the world, right? It comes from this statement in the Talmud, right? The moment of conception, 40 days before you can even see the Vlad, is when the neshama is placed into the body.
It's as closest as we get to creation.
Yeah, it's a close, right? That's beautiful. It's the closest that any human being can have to mimic God and create, bringing a new soul into the world. Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to paraphrase the next statement in the Talmud. This is an important one and a famous one. You might be familiar with it. It's in Tractate Nida. And what it describes is a very busy time. That the neshama, the soul in the fetus, is very busy during those 9 months that it spends in its mother's womb. So has anyone heard what the soul, the neshama, is doing during that time? So I heard this as a child, and I never actually ended up studying it inside. If you want, later on your own time, you can read the beginning of this of Source 6 for yourselves and see just how good of a knowledge of human anatomy some of the rabbis had. It's pretty amazing how they described in great detail the way that a fetus would fold itself up in its mother's womb. It's amazing. But after that, I'm going to paraphrase from the bold words and on. The Talmud says that during the time that a fetus is developing, there is a great light, a ner daluk. It's a lamp or some kind of torch is lit in the womb, and it's placed on the head of a baby, of a preborn baby. Because of this light, a preborn child, can see from one end of the world to the other. Okay.
That's what they said about the CEO of the Queen.
Yeah, you're right. That language is borrowed from the statement in the Talmud. There was a famous Hasidic rabbi called the Chozev Lublin, the seer of Lublin. He was blind, so the irony was that he could see. And his students would say that he could see all corners of the world at once. Like, he could see what's happening in all different parts of the world. And it seems like that's how the Talmud's talking about a fetus, right? That the fetus has this amazing line of vision. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, what's it doing? The Talmud then says, the best time in a soul's existence is the time that it spends in its mother's womb. That is the greatest joy that a neshama can have. That it's basking in this great light, presumably the light of God, right? It's interesting that there are many references that when a person leaves this world, they go back to that same light, right? To the ner, to the light of God. That's not coincidentally why in the temple there was a ner tamid, a constant light. Right? Light is always a symbol of God's presence. And it's in the vlad, it's in the womb that the vlad, that the fetus, experiences the light of God. And has some amazing vision of sight because of it. Step two, what else happens? The child studies a lot of Torah. That's what the Talmud says. If you just want to read from the bottom line of Source 6, and we'll go to the next page. And they, presumably the angels, teach the unborn child the entire Torah. And as soon as he emerges into the air of the world, an angel comes and slaps him on his mouth, causing him to forget the entire Torah. Later commentaries say that this little kind of dot that we have above our mouth, what's it called? The philtrum.
Yeah.
Many rabbis read in that was the tap or the hit that the angel places on a human being on a person right as they come out. Okay, so you know, we're not going to question the scientific validity of this, but the angel teaches the entire Torah to every person, and then causes them in a moment as they come out, as they're born, to forget everything that they learned. The child does not leave the womb before it is made to take an oath. So three things: you get great light, right? Good vision plan. You get to study a lot of Torah, and you also, as you're about to come out, you're told to take a promise. And what is the context of the oath that is administered to the unborn child? He or she is told as follows: become a righteous person and not a wicked one. And even if the entire world says to you, you are righteous, be in your eyes like a wicked person. As in, don't think that you're always good, even if people tell you you're good. Right? Going after the parentheses. Be aware that the Holy One, blessed is he, is pure, and his heavenly servants are pure, and the soul that he placed in you is also pure. If throughout your sojourn on earth you guard it in purity, fine. But if not, I will take it back from you. It's a powerful vow at the end. One of our morning prayers is based on this section in the Talmud. This is my favorite prayer. And right after the blessings of the Torah, we say, Elokai, my God, Neshama shena tata bi tahora hi. The soul that you placed within me is pure. Atavarata, atayitzarta, atanefachta bi. You've created it, formed it, and placed it within me. And you blew it within me. Atanefachta bi, atameshamra bikir bi. You guard it within me. Vata ati bitlamimini. And in the future, you're going to take that soul from me. Right? There's going to be a moment where the soul goes back to heaven. Right? Ulachzira li lati lavo. But in the future, after my death, there will become a point where you'll give it back to me. And that's in the time of Mashiach, when there's Tchiyat HaMetim, the resurrection of the dead. Right? And then we say, for however long I'm here, God, please give me strength to do your will. And that's a reference to the vow that every Vlad takes as it's about to leave its mother's womb, is this command, please be righteous. I want to go back to the question about free will, right? If we didn't have free will, we wouldn't be told to take a vow, right? You take vows on things that you have control over. And so what is it that we have control over? Right? In the process of telling us about how a soul and a body enters this world, the Talmud is telling us there are a lot of things that you're not in control of. But one thing you control, and that's, are you going to be a tzaddik, are you going to be righteous, or are you going to be a rasha? Right? God makes us swear, and we don't all live up to that vow, and probably none of us live up to it entirely. But our time here on earth is an attempt, right, to live up to that promise that we told God as we were about to leave the womb of our mothers. It's a powerful image.
So what's the purpose of teaching Torah just to make you forget?
Okay. So there's a lot more that I wanted to talk about, but I'm not going to, so I'll just finish with that point. So the idea of teaching Torah and the idea of that light that you can see the entire world over again, right? There's this conception, especially by the Kabbalists, that the soul in its essence is a part of God or is of God. Right? That's the pure neshama that we just spoke about in that prayer, right? And it's when it comes down to earth, it's given a toolkit, right? It's given a step-by-step guide for how to succeed in this world, right? And what is that step-by-step guide? It's the Torah, right? It's the mitzvot of the Torah. It's the stories of the Torah. It's the learning of Torah. That is the key for how to succeed in this world. But then the angel makes us forget it because we were supposed to have free will. And if we knew it all and we just remembered it all, right, it wouldn't be much of a choice. One of the things that I love and emerges from this is Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook's theology of tshuva, of repentance. Rav Cook says that tshuva, at the root of the word, it means to go back, to return to go back to where you came from. And for Rav Cook, every time we do a mitzvah, or every time we do tshuva, if we did something wrong and then we're trying to fix it, tshuva is not, I was bad and now I'm going to be good. Tshuva is, I'm going back to the pristine soul that was given to me and is still there. It's, I'm going back to my primordial, my womb state, right? When it was just me and God, and I felt my soul as part of God, right? When I knew the entire Torah. For the Rav Cook, every time you study Torah, right? And this is explicit in the Talmud, right? You're not studying something new. You're going back to something that you knew a long time ago. That's why Torah study is so powerful, right? It's not like studying physics. It's not like making a scientific discovery. It's learning something about yourself that was once there. And that's why we spend time studying Torah, right? It's a return to the self. So there's more interpretations of it, but that's at least one. Yeah.
Is it of a Jewish child that gets to learn Torah?
It's a great question. I'm not an expert, but I think it's every child. I think that it's clear in Talmudic literature that every person is born with a soul. I don't know what Torah is taught to every child, because I think there, you know, there's the mitzvot for the seven laws of Noah. So I'm not sure what Torah, but I think there is that idea that we're passed on with what's right and knowledge and truth of God that every person is born with innately. At least that's what I hope. Okay. Part two. Yeah, go for it.
When we were talking about the 40 days.
Yeah.
And you said that the Neshama is not there until after, or after you said that there will be a soul until, there will be a soul on conception, right?
So that was actually the rabbi who said, Rabbi Yehuda said, there's no soul on conception until 40 days later.
Okay.
And then Antonina said, no, it's there from the moment of conception. Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, you know, sometimes women have, they lose a child.
Yeah.
And sometimes when they lose it before a certain time, they say, well, it was meant to happen because, who knows, it wasn't informed properly.
Right.
I'm wondering if it was meant to happen because they didn't have the soul.
Yeah. I hear you. I don't know. It's a great question. I don't know.
Something like ease of it's,
yeah. It's a great question.
Sadness.
Yeah. I think, yeah, it's hard. Miscarriage is really tough at any stage. But it's an interesting thing. It's an interesting approach to it. Okay. So this is kind of a good segue for what we're going to talk about now, which is the laws of what is the status, right, of an unborn fetus or an unborn embryo. The 40-day marker is actually an important marker. Some post-scheme think that there's a difference between a pre-40-day pregnancy and a post-40-day pregnancy. That happens to be less of a significant view. So I want to actually now transition from Jewish thought into Jewish law and map out very briefly the basic building blocks of the Jewish position on this. I think many of us are conditioned to thinking, in part because of the Catholic influence in the country and on legislature, that the Jewish view on abortion is just like the Catholic or the evangelical view on abortion, which is that it's basically all bad. And the Torah view on abortion is much more nuanced. And so we're going to spend not so much time going through that. I'm going to summarize a lot of this outside. Okay? So here we go, quickly. So verse 7. In Exodus, Shmot, this is the laws of damages and accidental murders. One of the cases that comes up is what happens when there are two men fighting, and then they're intending to hurt each other, but there's a pregnant woman next to them, and inadvertently, as they're fighting with each other, one of them knocks the pregnant woman over, and she ends up miscarrying. Okay? So that's the setup or the situation in the Torah itself in Shmot. And the language that the Torah uses is, so v'lo yason, anoshi enesh. That person who accidentally hit the woman should be surely punished. Okay? It doesn't tell us how to punish her, this person, this man, who has knocked over the woman. The woman survives, right? Lo yason means she was, it was not a disaster for her, but she lost the, yeah, okay. As it not a disaster means she didn't die, but he should be punished for the miscarriage of the fetus. Okay? So what is the punishment that he should be given? Okay, so let's pause and say, we know from context that there's a general law for accidental murder. Anyone know offhand, what is the law if you accidentally kill someone? So monetary is not generally the law for accidental murder. It's the obligation to run to the Ir Miklat, right, to the city of refuge, and then the relatives of the person you accidentally killed have the right, it's a Goel Hadam, they become the redeemer of blood, they have the right to kill you unless if you're in the city of refuge. Right, so like touch home base and you're safe, right? Get to the city of refuge and you're safe. What's interesting here is that the Torah doesn't use that paradigm to describe what to do about the miscarriage, right? So what? Look at Rashi in source 8, which is also codified by Maimonides and the Shulchan Aruch, etc. So Rashi says, Anoshi Aneshi, that man shall be punished, Yigbu Mamon Menu. you should have to take out money from him. And it shows a similar case in Devarim where the word onesh for punishment is a reference to monetary punishment. Okay? So what is the punishment for an accidental abortion?
Not necessarily. Onesh could be also prison.
Onesh can mean a bunch of different kinds of punishment. Sometimes onesh means capital punishment. Right? If you kill someone purposely, then in biblical times it would be capital punishment as a consequence. So what the rabbinic reading of this verse, and it's actually pretty consistent with other biblical verses, is that the punishment is monetary. Okay, so let's pause and reflect on that for a second. If it's monetary punishment, right, and it's not capital punishment, right, and it's not even the parallel to what happens if you accidentally murder a person as opposed to if you do it on purpose, right, what is the Torah telling us about the killing of a fetus?
Less consequential than killing a person.
Right. It's not the same as killing a person.
Well, if it's accidental.
If it's,
yeah, that's the context.
You're right. The context here is accidental. The Torah does not give us a case of what if you purposely knock over a woman and cause her to miscarry.
It also doesn't give us how many months she was pregnant.
Doesn't tell us how far into her pregnancy she was. Yeah. Great. So that seems to be by the way, this is the only biblical reference to abortion. Purposeful or accidental abortion. It's the only explicit reference in the Torah, which is, by the way, going to lead the rabbis to a problem, because, hint, abortion as a general statement is not a good idea from within the rabbinic tradition. Okay, so...
Tradition or law?
Say that again?
Tradition or law?
Law, but it's unclear what kind of law, so we'll get there.
Okay.
Because there's always a difference between if something is biblically prohibited, it's much more strict. If it's only rabbinically prohibited, then it's much more lenient, and sometimes there's rooms to override that. So that's where we're gonna get. You see this codified in the Mishnah and Ohalot, and the Rambam says this as well, that if there is a woman, this is source 9, Isha Shehi Makshelelet, a woman who's in a very difficult labor, and she's having a very hard time giving birth. And the way it's interpreted is if she's at the point where during the labor she's about to die as a consequence of it, the Mishnah says, Mechatchim et havlad b'me'eha, you're allowed to cut up the fetus, sorry, this is graphic, within her innards, right, within her womb. Umotzino ta'ivarim avarim, and you're allowed to take it apart piece by piece. This happens to be a conversation that I think was debated in the Supreme Court 20 or 30 years ago, very similar kind of abortion. Is that permitted according to the nation's laws? Okay, so the Mishnah here is saying that if it's endangering the mother's life, right, you're allowed to abort the child even very late into the pregnancy. Right? This is during labor. It's during delivery, right? So why are you allowed to do that? The Mishnah continues, Mipnei shechayeha kodmin l'chayav, because her life, the mother's life, comes before the life of the fetus. Interesting principle. You're going to have to elucidate that a little bit more. However, and there's an exception to this, this is part two of the Mishnah, yatsa rubo, once the majority of the baby comes out, right, certainly once the head comes out, right, ein no ginbo, you're no longer allowed to touch the baby, right? She'ein dochin nefesh mipin ein nefesh. You're not allowed to push one soul off for another soul. So it's a terrible thing that we should never face ourselves. If the Mishnah statement, right, if in delivery the child has not yet been birthed, right, has not yet, either only a tiny bit of it has gone out of the womb or the uterus, right, but not the majority of it. Until, if the majority of the baby has not yet left, you kill the baby and save the mother. But once the baby has, a majority of it has left, now they're both being treated as equal human lives, and you're not allowed to touch it because you can't kill one life for the sake of another life. Okay? So what does this tell us about abortion? Tells us that certainly under some circumstances, specifically when a pregnancy is endangering a mother's life, right, at least until very far into the labor, right, you are allowed to abort fetuses to protect the life of the mother. Right? Not only are you allowed to, you're obligated to. Maimonides, so here's a few of the background principles for this Mishnah. Okay, one is a statement in the Talmud. It's an interesting language, choice of language. Ubar yerach imo. That a fetus is like a limb of its mother. You hear similar arguments to this in the pro-choice movement today, right? That women should have the decision to what to do with their bodies. And the Talmud actually has this statement that a fetus is part of its mother's body. So that's one principle that's at play here. Turn the page. Another principle, and Maimonides makes this explicit, is the concept of rodef. Rodef is a pursuer, someone who's chasing after you. We know in Sanhedrin, there's a famous, this is a famous case. We bring this up with middle schoolers when we're trying to teach them Jewish perspectives on ethics. Right? If someone points a gun to your head and says, right, eat a cheeseburger. Do you eat the cheeseburger?
Yes,
you eat the cheeseburger, right? If someone points a gun to your head and says, point a gun to someone else's head, right? Are you allowed to shoot that other person? And the Talmud says, no, you have to be prepared to give up your own life. It's one of the three cardinal sins that you're not allowed to break. The Talmud then goes and gives the case. What if someone is coming and trying to kill you? Are you permitted to kill them first?
Yes.
Yes, it's a concept of rodef. Right, a pursuer. If a pursuer is coming to try to hurt you, kill you, where it's a real life threat, threats your life, you're not only permitted, you're obligated to kill them first. The way that Maimonides explains that Mishnah that we just studied is that until it's born, an ubar, a fetus, if it's endangering the mother's life, is a rodef, is a pursuer, and you're obligated to kill pursuers. So that's a case in which abortion is clear. Problem is, once the baby is born, or at least once the majority of it comes out, this is the problem. There's two rodefs, right? There's two pursuers, because the baby is endangering the mother, but at that point, the mother is also endangering the baby. And once you have two human lives, and it seems very clear that biblically speaking, at least, according to the Mishnah, right, a human life fully is considered fully human once it's born, or majority born. Right, at that point, you can't act on either, because to kill one would be either one you would kill is being pursued by the other, or is pursuing the other. Okay. The Talmud takes it for granted that despite the fact, and by the way, the commentaries point out that what's the difference, actually, just to make it explicit, Tosfot Yom Tov, verse 10, is an important commentary in the Mishnah, and he says, what's the difference about abortion pre-delivery versus post-delivery? He actually uses the word, and this is interesting because it contradicts some stuff we said before. He says that once a baby is actually out in the air of the world, avir ha'olam, it attains its nefesh. Nefesh is one of the Hebrew words for soul. And once it attains its nefesh, it's considered fully human. And once you get to that point, you can't prioritize the mother over the child because they're both equal nefeshot. Problem is that we just said that the soul of the person it comes in at the moment that they're conceived.
But that was an issue.
Great. So the language there, there's different elements of the human soul, and the element that is described at the point of conception is neshama, and this kind of soul, nefesh, is much more about the life force, right? It's about the independent sustain, is the ability of a human or a mammal to sustain its own life. That's so, normally how nefesh is used. So it's different kinds of this, parts of the soul.
So
yeah.
If I understand this correctly.
Okay.
After 40 days,
yeah,
the unborn is established. You can't, unless that potential child jeopardizes the mother, there's no abortion.
Let's deal with that question now. That I haven't answered that question. I've left that purposely ambiguous. Oh. So what we've defined for now halakhically is if there is a fetus endangering its mother's life, the fetus is not considered as human as the mother. Right, and you're obligated to kill the fetus to protect and save the life of the mother. That changes the moment that the baby is born. Then they're both considered to be totally equal in halachic stature as fully living humans. Okay, here's the problem. What about what about abortions that are not to protect the mother's life?
That's the question.
That's the question. So let's deal with that. Okay. Right, heavy stuff.
I would say that it's not legal. You can't do it.
Okay. And the answer is?
According to
what we saw so far. The answer is machloked. It's a debate.
It's a debate, really. So,
yeah. It's, right. When I said there's nuance here, I meant it. Okay. So the Talmud and Sanhedrin.
In the case of the baby and the mother, so what's the other half?
We'll get there.
That's what we just asked.
Okay. So the Talmud has a problem that the Torah forbids murder, And it's pretty clear from everything we've seen until now that the Torah does not prohibit killing a fetus as a form of human murder, right? It doesn't, when it says, lo tirzak, you should not kill, that's talking about fully born humans and not talking about fetuses. However, the rabbis say, and this is in source 11, you can read it for yourselves later, Rabbi Shmuel, that one of the part of the Noahide law of not spilling blood, right? It's the prohibition to murder in the Noahide laws is not about do not kill, it's about don't spill blood, right? And included in that, according to the Talmud, is a prohibition not to kill, not to do abortions, right? So there's actually a prohibition, according to the Talmud, from the Noahide laws, not to perform abortions. It's a very complicated, but part of the problem is, well, that didn't get repeated at Mount Sinai, right? So what does that mean for us, right? Maybe abortion, it's interesting, maybe there's a case to say that abortion is biblically prohibited for Gentiles, but not biblically prohibited for Jews. And the Talmud hates that answer and says, like, no, every of the seven Noahide laws has to be at least the same standard within the Torah itself for Jews. So the problem is that we don't really have a good answer about what is the Jewish biblical prohibition of abortion. And I've seen at least six or seven different rabbinic interpretations about what the prohibition of abortion is. Okay, so I'm going to run through a few of them. One is, maybe it's the same as the prohibition not to masturbate for men. It's interesting, right? Masturbation is a form of spilling seed, right? It's wasted human life. And maybe, right, even a fetus, kal vachomer, all the more so, is even closer to being a fully developed human life. So maybe it's under that rubric. Others, bal tashchit, thou shalt not waste. Don't be wasteful. Similar in concept. Only problem is that Maimonides says that the biblical prohibition against wasting is only about fruit trees in the land of Israel. Right? Other than that, not being wasteful, according to Maimonides, is only rabbinic prohibition. So rabbinic, much lower in status. Much, I won't say lower in status, but different than biblical.
Onan
okay.
was punished for wasting the seed.
Onan was.
Yeah,
dealing with Onan, Aaron Onan is a really complicated biblical story. It's been interpreted, Onanism, right, is the colloquial interpretation of what happened there. Mm-hmm. Lots of rabbinic writing about that and what the status of masturbation is, and that's not our topic tonight. Interesting thoughts from different rabbis. One rabbi says that to abort a fetus under normal circumstances, not when it's endangering the mother, right, it's not murder, but it's avuz raihu to resicha. It's like the dust of murder. It's too similar to murder to be permitted, right? And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, probably the most important halachic decisor of the 20th century in America, not in Israel, said he actually took the standard that killing a fetus is full-blown murder. The only exception is it doesn't come with the death penalty. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Last but not least.
What penalty does it come with?
No biblical penalty in terms of action, but a biblical prohibition nonetheless. And Tzitz Eliezer, it's an important rabbi who passed away about 20 years ago in Israel. It was Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. He wrote 11 volumes of medical halachic responsa, and he was the rabbi of, I believe, Shari Chesed Hospital in Jerusalem. So he was amazing in that he was a medical expert and a rabbi, kind of like the Maimonides of 20th century Israel. And he actually said that, no, it's pretty clear, the fact that the Talmud can't actually define what abortion is, right, that we can't root it in biblical prohibitions, at least for Jews, it's clear that abortion is a prohibition, but only rabbinic in nature. And when you deal with rabbinic prohibitions, you can't do it all whenever you want, but there's much more leeway to permit abortion. When would we maybe permit abortion for Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg and the school of rabbis who think that it's only rabbinic in nature? So they actually quote, this is a very unusual precedent, but this is how legal minds work. You have to find from other precedents. Okay. We don't impose this anymore. We haven't done it in 2,000 years. And even when we did do it, the Talmud says that a Beit Din that would do capital punishment once in either 7 or 70 years would be called a very bloody Beit Din. So capital punishment was exceedingly uncommon. However, capital punishment is a possibility according to the Torah as a consequence for certain crimes. Okay? What if there's a woman who is liable to the death penalty, a capital punishment, and is pregnant? What do you do? The Mishnah...
Deliver the baby first.
You would think deliver the baby. And the Mishnah says, if she's not yet in labor, this is the Mishnah in Source 12, you can read it later, If she's not yet in labor, don't wait for the baby to be born. Kill the mother, even though you know it's going to lead to the death and abortion of the baby. And when the Talmud's trying to understand what's the sort, like what's the, how, why, the Talmud brings up the concept of inui hadin, that there is a specific kind of torture you can imagine for people on death row nowadays of knowing that you're liable of death before you're actually killed. It's a specific form of torture. And the rabbis want to avoid. You're liable to the death penalty? Fine, right? But we're not going to add any more torture or difficulty beyond that specific punishment. And so what the Mishnah says is that it's permitted to kill a pregnant woman who's liable to the death penalty immediately, not wait till she delivers the child, because the waiting period itself is a form of torture. So what do you see here? Some of the rabbis, Rabbi Eliezer, Waldenberg, etc., bring a precedent from here that there are specific cases, right, when not aborting a child leads to extreme discomfort or difficulty for a pregnant mother, that it might be permitted based on that precedent, right, to abort the child. Not because it's endangering the physical life of the mother, right, but it's endangering the mental well-being or the emotional state of the mother. Examples of this in classic periods, and by classic I mean 100, 200, 300 years ago, because this has been written about, right? Unwanted pregnancies are not a new phenomenon, right? They've been happening forever, right? So some examples of this could be if a woman gets pregnant and she's unmarried and she lives in a very conservative society, right? Such that there would be kind of like a mark placed on her for the rest of her life. There were poskim going back 200, 300 years who would, under certain circumstances, permit abortion because of the exceeding difficulty it would place on her for the rest of her life. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, right, I mentioned him before, he says that abortion is total murder, right? He would say absolutely not. But there is I won't say it's a minority, there is a school of rabbinic thinkers and post-king living today who do permit abortion even when the mother's physical life is not in danger under certain circumstances. So I'm not going to poskin on this case now. I will say that one of the difficult challenges of medical ethics in the modern era is that often parents, this is my last point on the halacha, often parents find out early or even in middle stages of pregnancies that they are carrying a fetus that is either not viable, right, that it won't survive birth, or that will survive with significant mental or physical disabilities. That's a case that's being debated now. And there are different rabbis on different sides of the issue. Are you allowed to permit abortion, right, in the case where the mother is healthy, but it may lead to tremendous long-term consequences for the child and obviously the entire family around the child as well? So that's another evaluation point. A lot we covered today. I hope you feel like you understand the spiritual journey that a soul undertakes as it's entering into the world. Both the moment of conception, what is decided for us and what is left for us to decide. What is it that we spend our time doing in the womb of our parents? How that's an opportunity for the rest of our lives to live up to those commitments, to that experience of Hashem that we had when we were still in our mother's wombs. And hopefully we can live up to that vow that we took. How significant it is when we are born into this world that we have the opportunity to do that. And then on the halachic side, this was a short taste of the very complicated discussion around abortion in Judaism. If there's one takeaway you have, I think it's that abortion is generally not recommended, but under some circumstances, specifically physical endangerment of the mother, is obligated. And more complicated is the emotional and psychological and mental health well-being of mothers. And there are sometimes leniencies for abortion under those circumstances as well. Yeshika, have a great night.
When people use the term